is the Meat Eater Podcast coming at you shirtless, severely bug bitten, and in my case, underwearless.
We hunt the Meat Eater Podcast.
You can't predict anything.
All right, John Gierak, I'm going to start by kind of, I'm going to make you uncomfortable and butter you up. I've wanted to talk to you for 20 years, I think. Or what year did Trout Bum come out?
Mid-80s, maybe 86.
I didn't discover it till a little bit later than that. But I've been wanting to talk to you since I did, because there's a thing like that book, which was your first book, right?
No, second.
Because you had the Fly Fish in the High Countries before that.
Yep.
But Trout Bum fell into, when I say our lap, I mean the laps of me, my brothers, and like our main hunting and fishing friends that we grew up with. And it fell into our lap at this time in life that will always stick in my head, because it was, we were kind of coming out of college, being mid-college, and there was just this tremendous amount of anxiety that was unspoken at the time, but there was sort of like a lot of, there's just like this palpable anxiety in the air about what we were all going to, what was going to happen to us all.
Yeah. Jimmy, well, like, not like now, right?
No, I just feel like I know better. I kind of like, now I have anxiety about my kids, right? But at the time I just, yeah, I know, I kind of could picture it all now, but at the time I couldn't picture it, and there's like a tremendous amount of anxiety. But there's a thing that we were just discovering, is that we'd all grown up fishing all the time, because yeah, our dads fished. We just fished. But all of a sudden, it was like, it seemed like there's so much possibility out in the world. And we were starting to screw around with traveling to go places and just do nothing, and almost making like a conscious decision to not have a lot of the material goods that you saw other people going toward at that age. Mm-hmm. Because we were just really in love with just messing around with our friends and camping and pooling your money together to buy gas, to go fish somewhere, and doing these things that didn't make sense, and you're doing all the stuff that doesn't make sense, and you felt like anxiety about it and some level of guilt about it, because it didn't seem sustainable and seemed foolish and childish, but we were so in love with how we were living. And then I read when your book came out, man, and I remember this so clearly all these years later and all the things I've read since then, but it was like, it made me feel like, oh my God, this is okay. Like, this is a thing that people do and that happens to people. And there's like a way you can live your life like this.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was going to say, I recognize everything you said except the guilt part. I never felt an ounce of guilt.
You never had the guilt?
No. No,
but you grew
no,
up in just, like a you grew up in a working class family, though.
Yeah.
That didn't rub off. I mean, not that you don't work, but I mean, you didn't have that sense of like that you needed to be, that you needed to be doing something you didn't like.
Well, I had the sense I needed to make a living, and I always did. I mean, I worked all kinds of jobs. Even while I was writing, I worked a lot of odd jobs and part-time jobs and full-time jobs sometimes, and just to get by.
Because you were brought up in Ohio, right?
Well, born in Illinois, small town Illinois. Moved to Minnesota for a while, moved to Ohio. Dad worked for Sears, so we moved around. I was in Ohio for my last 2 years of high school, and then I went to college in Ohio. And then after that, I was in New York, I was in Colorado, I was in Haight-Ashbury.
Really? And you studied philosophy?
Yeah.
Like, explain that. Like, I don't mean to explain philosophy, but what was your,
I was going to say, how long you got, man.
Why? I mean, what kind of led you to that?
Well, I started out as an English major, and always hard for me to say that without thinking of Garrison Keillor now. But I don't know. I didn't like the way they taught. It was an arrogant thing to say, but I didn't like the way they taught English literature. It was just, you know, it was like it was code and you were supposed to decode it. And it was like they kept asking, what does the author mean? And I kept asking, why can't he just mean what he said?
Yeah. I remember that being difficult too, and then the way they kind of march you through the timeline being frustrating as well.
Mm-hmm.
Like, all right, we'll start with Beowulf.
Yeah, yeah.
And this year we'll make it to Shakespeare, and then we'll pick up and
mm-hmm.
yeah, and yeah. Like, so talking about hitting meanings, and like you'd read something and dig it, but then you felt like, well, I must not have really liked it, because when they asked me for what it meant, I can't tell you what the symbolism was. I liked it, if that counts for anything.
Yeah. Well, you know, I can sort of do it now, but I've read probably thousands of books since then. I mean, I think you don't do enough reading by the time you're studying English in college. I think you haven't done enough reading yet.
Oh, you mean like it's premature?
Yeah. Yeah. Right. I mean, you're just being introduced to literature. And you're being asked to look at it as deeply as anyone ever looks at it.
Got you.
And I think maybe you should read for 20 years and then study English. I don't know. I mean, there is only so much time, but...
Yeah. I remember meeting a guy. I was fishing with a late friend of mine on the Big Hole River. I'm sure you've fished that river in Montana. Mm-hmm. We're on the Big Hole River. And we met a guy who had... was explaining to us that he had been a doctor and had just recently retired.
Mm-hmm.
And the two things he was never able to do as a doctor was read and fish. And so now he was devoting his retirement to fishing in the morning.
Mm-hmm.
And then while he was still fresh of mind, to go and read. And he had in his head that he was going to read, even at the word he used, he was going to read the canon.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And it struck me as like, you'll probably get more out of it than I did when I read the canon starting at 18 years of age.
Exactly. Exactly.
Yeah. So you bumped to philosophy.
Yeah.
And was there like a thing you thought you were going to go do with it? Like, did you want to be a philosophy teacher?
No. I mean, I realized at some point that that was what you did. Right?
No, I don't understand.
I mean, if you were going to get a degree in philosophy...
That's the only outlet.
You're not going to go home and hang out your shingle, you know.
Yeah.
You're going to be a teacher. That's it. Or you're going to go to law school, because law schools liked philosophy majors, because they could read complicated stuff and
gotcha.
Figure out what it meant. But I don't know. I was just never – I wasn't on that track. It was the
– Man, a bird just banged against the window, huh?
Yeah.
Is he dead?
No.
No.
No, I saw him go. He's all right.
Tie some flies with him.
those were doves. We could have eaten them.
so sorry.
I just wasn't on a career track. It was the 60s. And we were hippies, and we weren't looking to go to the office every day.
But you liked to fish at that point, too, because you grew up fishing.
I did.
But
I didn't do much. The last... 2 years of high school, and we lived in northern, you know, Rust Belt, northern Ohio.
Yeah.
And then in college, I mean, it just wasn't fishing around.
Yeah. Unless you're, you know, fishing bullheads and stuff like that. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And when I lived in northern Ohio, that's when the Cuyahoga River caught fire every couple of years. And
got you.
Lake Erie would eat the paint off of ships coming in. And like, nobody wants to fish in that.
So you just didn't feel a strong connection to it there. At that time.
I didn't feel any connection to it at all.
When in this, because if you're self-described like that you were a hippie or affiliated with the counterculture and were familiar with fishing, did you at the time were you reading like Trout Fishing in America by Brodigan? I don't remember what year that came out, but
that came out later. I did read it.
So what were your thoughts of that?
And you know, the Curtis Creek Manifesto and all that stuff. My thoughts. Well, I always liked Brodigan. He might be a little thin in retrospect, but I liked him at the time.
Yeah, Brodigan's like Tom Robbins. I don't know if you read Tom, but later you can't go read Tom. Like once you get in your 40s and you have kids and stuff, you can't go. Like it doesn't hold up.
Right.
You're not like, holy shit, this guy's a genius.
Yeah.
It's kind of like, how did I used to think this was good? But Brodigan's still funny though, man.
He is still funny. Yeah.
Did not have a funny end.
No.
So if you, here's, I guess I'm kind of driving at this. maybe I should just ask you. At what point did you like make these connections? Like, there is such a thing as a guy. There's such a thing as a guy who writes about an activity like fishing, and if he is really good, can make a living at it, and I will shoot for that.
I was probably in the mid-70s, because, you know, when I got into fly fishing, I didn't get into fly fishing until I came out west. In my early 20s, late 60s, early 70s, never really seen it before. It's that in the Midwest, you never saw people fly fishing. You do now,
mm-hmm.
but you didn't then. And I just got into it for what I think were the purest reasons. I thought, that's beautiful. That's the prettiest thing I've ever seen.
Really?
And
I mean, just the act of it.
Yeah. Yeah, and people are catching fish, and I thought, that is just friggin' beautiful.
What was the year that you had that sort of thought or epiphany?
I don't know, late 60s.
Okay.
Maybe 70, maybe 1970. And at some point, I mean, I was still trying to be a serious writer then. I had a little book of poetry in print. I was writing for little literary magazines. But I was fly fishing, and I was reading Fly Fisherman magazine. I don't think Fly Fishing the West was out. I think Trout, Salmon, and Steelheader was out then. There weren't many. And I just sort of, and of course, there were the, you know, Field and Stream, Outdoor Life. And guys like Lee Wolf around, and I just thought, well, people do make a living at this.
Did you feel like it was coarse and low because you were an aspiring poet? Did you feel like it was less artful to become like a writer with sort of a beat, you know?
Not really. I mean, there were people I knew at the time who thought it was. I mean, I had writer friends at the time
who thought it wasn't like the fine arts.
Yeah. And maybe it's not like the fine arts. I don't know.
Most it's not. But I think that the reason that you're you, and the reason that you've been around so long and people like you so much, is that you're one of the rare few who has transcended.
Well, what it was reading Tom McGuane, Jim Harrison, Russ Chatham, some of those guys.
Yeah.
And also, you know, the new journalists were working then. Tom Wolfe, Hunter Thompson, Peter Matheson. And they were sort of bringing literary techniques into what had normally been journalism up to now. They were dropping the pretense of objectivity and becoming characters in their own stories.
Yeah.
And writing in a stream of consciousness. I mean, you know, electric Kool-Aid acid test was not a news story.
Yeah.
About LSD. It was, you know, a little deeper than that.
Yeah.
But I think it was probably the single writer that showed me that this could be done as well as any other kind of writing. It could be just as legitimate as literature was Tom McGuane and some of his earlier stuff.
So you were reading his stuff then?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Like 92 in the Shade and some of the, I don't know if that was one of his earlier works.
Yeah, but also his, you know, he wrote for Sports Afield or, I don't know, he wrote for some of the magazines. And
Harrison back then, like in the 70s, Harrison was doing hunting and fishing pieces for Sports Illustrated.
Yeah.
It's amazing in that era. Even though participation was not super high in this country, in that era, the room that mainstream publications made for like hook and bullet writing of the mm-hmm. finest, highest caliber,
yeah,
would find its way into very mainstream magazines.
Yeah, Esquire.
But that's also something I've always been like a thing that if I look at sort of the stuff I've written and where it's been, I'm always kind of like proudest of those moments when I've been able to take and wedge a thing about hunting and fishing in an unexpected location. I always feel like it's like counting coup almost.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, to be able to stick it in somewhere where no one would ever expect to see it.
Right. It's like being a sniper.
Yeah. but you're shooting stories instead of bullets.
Yeah.
You know, do you know, this is a side note out of any kind of chronology we're following with you, but you might have some perspective on it. One of the things that troubles me most about fishing writing is that why does spin tackle not spawn great writers? That's a mixed metaphor. Why does spin tackle, spin fishing, not produce the writers that fly fishing does? I kind of get it, but I don't get it.
Mm-hmm. I don't know. That's a good question. I've never given it a moment's thought. But it could be just that writers tend to be attracted to fly fishing because it's, you know, it's old and it's kind of primitive and it's complex and the aesthetics are complicated and there's a lot to write about. And
so you think it's that like the writerly sensibility is drawn to fly fishing rather than like fly fishing inspires writers?
Yeah, maybe. Like I say, I've never thought of it before. But you're right. Name a great spin fishing writer.
Zane Grey wrote some pretty good pieces about. Now it was mostly ocean.
Yeah, because I was gonna say fishing. Papa.
Yeah, Hemingway.
Hemingway wrote about deep water.
Well, yeah. and he wrote about fishing trout with worms too. And Hopper's Big Two-Hearted River.
Yeah.
Fishing live bait. So, I mean, it's out there, but I don't think anybody would consider Hemingway a fishing writer.
Well, I mean, he's definitely, like, informed by that, and I think that he's, like, recognized as being... Yeah, mm-hmm. I mean, he's recognized as much of being a dude who liked to watch bullfights as he is the guy that liked to hunt fish, but he definitely had that. But did Zane Grey fly fish?
I don't know. I've only read offshore. I think it was Fishing... Virgin Seas is the book I have at home. And
well, he did some steelheading too.
But he not only was just a writing about it, he was like an innovator of tackle and equipment. Mm. I mean, he goes into great depths describing like making custom line back when they didn't have line that could hold up to an 800-pound marlin, and then the great depths that he went to have this line or the product shipped from, you know, who knows where, and then it was, you know, spun somewhere else, and then you do all these tests and still the big ones would get away. But
so he was hardcore. He wasn't just a trigger man.
Mm-mm.
No.
No, he was into it.
What was the first do you recollect what year was the first year that you wrote a fishing piece where you looked at it and thought, like, that's not technical writing, it's not how to, but it's like a piece of art about fishing? And that you published?
I think I felt that about the essays in Trout Bum. So, and they were not, you know, it came out in, I swear it was 86. So probably by the late 70s, I was starting to do that.
Like the writing things, you're like, this is what I want to do, and I just did that well.
Yeah, yeah.
And you were placing them where?
I was placing them in fishing magazines. I was in Sports Afield, Field and Stream, Fly Fisherman, now defunct magazine called Fly Fishing the West. I don't think Fly Rod and Reel was still Rod and Reel then. John Merwin had it.
Mm-hmm. And I recognize that name.
Published in there and here and there.
And those could not have been, huge paychecks to write in those places. Mm-mm. So you kind of knew that you probably knew that you had to go toward books.
I wanted to go towards books. I think all writers want to see their name on the cover of a book.
Yeah.
Right? Don't you? I mean, magazines.
Yeah, I hate to see someone else's name on the cover of my book.
Yeah, magazines come and go, newspapers. I had a fight with my, I used to write outdoor column for the newspaper for 28 years.
Yeah, I want to ask you about that, but go ahead.
They totally screwed up one of my columns. Doesn't matter why, but they totally mucked it up. And I called my editor and yelled at him, and he said,
"Hold on, but what does that mean? Like, what did it? What happened to it?"
Well, they ran it in four columns, four vertical columns at the top of the page, but the columns weren't in the right order.
Got you.
So it read like gibberish.
Okay.
And I called and yelled at him, and he said, "Man, that was yesterday." He said, "It's on the bottom of a birdcage by now."
Yeah.
So.
It's a shitty feeling.
Yeah. But he's right.
Yeah.
You know.
But it's like, it's painful to articulate it that way, though.
Yeah.
But there's a truth to it.
Yeah. But that's newspapers.
That's the problem with newspapers and magazines, if you're going to bring up the idea of having your name on the book, because I've considered myself like a pretty careful reader, okay? And I'm aware of the publishing world, and I pay attention to what's going on. I'll read pieces, and later someone will be like, "Who wrote the piece?" Like, you know what?
You don't know.
As much as I've spent my life pursuing this and in this business, I never looked.
Mm-hmm.
And then you imagine that, and if you think of yourself as like a careful reader who's paying attention, and you imagine how most people perceive it, it makes you hungry for something that, it makes you hungry for something that's more, that you could just like continue to point to it as this thing that you did.
Mm-hmm.
Because it sounds shallow in some ways and vain, but people do want to be like recognized for their work.
Yeah. And, you know, I wouldn't be the first writer that was shallow and vain, right?
No.
If there wasn't
a little hint of it, you wouldn't be a writer.
Yeah, I mean, we do sign our work, right? We could all write under a pseudonym and be anonymous, but we don't. Not many of us do. And the other thing is, I mean, people are going to, somebody reads a book and likes it, they're going to remember who wrote it, and a book could conceivably last. No guarantees. But, you know, a book could last. Whereas a magazine, right, it's going to end up on the coffee table in a dentist's office eventually, and then it's going to get recycled, and it's going to be gone.
People don't retain them.
Well, some people do. Some people save every issue of some magazine.
Yeah, but I mean, not like they retain a book, man. When people are done reading a book, they don't throw it in the garbage. They go bring it to a donation center.
Well, or they put it in the bookshelf. You saw my office.
Yeah.
I don't know how many books I have down there.
When you came out with your first book, and then many, I know many of your subsequent books, and you can correct me if it's in fact all of them, are collected pieces.
Mm-hmm.
Do all of your books appear in print before they go into your books? Or do you have original material that appeared nowhere else that goes into your books?
There's been original material that appeared nowhere else. And most of the stuff that was originally published somewhere else has been expanded into a book chapter.
Have you ever thought about, why is it that you haven't done a... Like a full narrative book?
I did. At the Grave of the Unknown Fisherman.
Oh, that is?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Tell me about that book. Like what that was like doing. Or what it was like doing that book.
It was, you know, it was one of those seasons of the Angler thing. I mean, it was a four-season thing. And I just had this idea that would be the way to do a book, is to go through the seasons. And I wrote the chapters as essays, and I published most of them in magazines and then collected them into a book.
Yeah. The thing about your writing that things I kind of admire most about it is even like the books, your books are often collections of pieces that are freestanding pieces. Like they, mm-hmm. they make sense and work in a freestanding form, like chapter length form.
Mm-hmm.
But throughout it is this broader story of you and your life and your friends. And one of the things that most strikes me in it is that the affection and love you have for friends that have been your friends for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
And you come to kind of know them, and you have a way of really capturing this long arc of friendship and how it works and goes from you being young and then you're kind of not young, right, together.
Mm-hmm.
And then you're all kind of like past some tipping point headed in another direction together. And it does together create this sense of that it is this long meta narrative.
Yeah.
And another thing that happens that was really striking me with your new book is that I'm looking at it like you're always somewhere else, right? You're always on trips. Mm-hmm. You travel. It seems like you travel incessantly. And in A Fly Rod of Your Own, you're gone. You spend a lot of time in Labrador. You're up in Alaska. You're fishing around Colorado. I think you're in Washington.
Mm-hmm.
You spend time in Idaho. I don't even know where else in your new book. But while this is going on, there's like this life that you're having where your mother's dying.
Yeah.
There's a big forest fire ripping by your house, and you're on this trip in Maine checking in back home. And there's like chores that didn't get taken care of back home. And there's a flood that destroys the property of people that you're close with back home. And I think that a lot of writers like with travel writing is sort of, it's that you're just immersed in the experience, but you do well, I think, at capturing all just like the nagging shit
mm-hmm.
that you cannot escape from.
Yeah.
Like I used to joke about that if you look at like what a writer writes, what's in a writer's head, they don't match up, because if you spend a bunch of time somewhere and you're writing about it, you're just like really cherry picking the opportunities. An example would be, we do a show where an episode of the show is 22 minutes long, but we'll go, how many hours, Giannis, how many hours of footage would we film?
It's 100 to 1 most of the time.
So 100 to 1 ratio.
Mm-hmm.
Now, when you go and put together, if you go on a trip and you're gone 4 or 5 days and you put together 22 minutes, you are like cherry picking.
Yeah.
You're not creating a representation of what exactly happened there. Because if you were, for every 2 minutes that you watched, there'd be 1 minute where you're watching people sleep.
Mm-hmm.
So you are doing like there's a fiction to nonfiction in that you're weighting things and talking about what's of interest.
Oh yeah. Well, and you're not only doing that, but you're pulling in memories, you're changing time. You know, time isn't always linear.
Yeah, and you certainly don't. And that's one of the things that, like, the craft of your writing too is you're not deceptive about chronology, but you're just very good at like dealing with
occasionally vague about it.
Yeah, yeah. Well, just like when you get done, when you're back from something, I think that you're not really concerned with, well, I did this, and then this, and then this, and then this. I think you're more concerned about, here's the flow of my ideas.
Yeah.
And I'm not going to be, I don't need to tell you, like, this happened, and that happened, and this happened, and that happened, necessarily in that order. Sometimes I'll see, like, I'll be cruising along in one of your pieces, and I'll all of a sudden, like, whatever, you flip the page, you realize it's about to end, and I'll think, my God, how is he going to... He doesn't have enough space left to get us back out of here. Right?
Right.
To do all this shit, to get on the airplanes and load, like, there's no space. And then all of a sudden you're just like, and that's all I have to say about that subject.
Yeah.
And it's just refreshing.
Well, it's why you never see anybody in the movies go to the bathroom.
Pulp Fiction.
Well, yeah, but
he dies. He gets shot in the bathroom. So.
But I mean, it's just assumed that people go to the bathroom throughout the movie, but you don't have to see it
exactly.
I mean, you don't have to tell everybody everything.
Yeah.
You tell them it's worth telling.
Yeah. But yeah, so I'm kind of saying two things that are crossways a little bit, because you do great with that, and you do great with delivering a version of a story that's most useful to the reader to get the reader where you want them to go. But in that calculation that you're making, you're also not abandoning all sense, because you get the sense in reading your work that you're still always very aware of the world that you left behind when you went somewhere.
Mm-hmm. Well, you are, aren't you?
Yeah, absolutely. But I think all people are, but I don't know that many people have really embraced it and has done as well as you've done it, where you can be writing about a trip you're on, but also you're writing about this kind of like the loss of your mother.
Mm-hmm.
And the weird family stuff that goes around the death of a family member, and what are your obligations to everyone when that happens. But it's all occurring sort of like this like humming noise in your head,
yeah,
while you fish. Like when you're out of town and you know something bad's happening at home, you can't escape it. And the rhythm with which you go from being in the moment to being, oh shit, there's a big fire by my house.
Yeah.
On the other, you know, 2,000 miles away. Is really, it's impressive.
Well, it's stream of consciousness, and it's more like, it's stream of consciousness writing seems familiar to people because it's how people think.
That's a good point.
You know, you don't spend an hour thinking about one thing. You spend an hour bouncing around about 20 things. And if you're writing, 17 of those things are of no interest to anyone, so you leave them out.
Yeah.
But you bounce around, and you know, you're someplace on a fishing trip, you see something that reminds you of something that happens at home, or somebody you haven't talked to at home, or whatever. And that's how people think, and so they recognize that in a piece of writing.
What is your gauge? How do you know, like when you get into something that's not interesting, the 17 things that aren't interesting to other people, who or what are you imagining to know when you've gotten there? That you're now into things that are of interest only to John Gierock?
Well, it's somebody, I think this was actually my old high school English teacher, said every time you say something as a writer, you have to ask yourself, okay, but who gives a shit?
Yeah.
And so you just do that. You say, why would anyone care about this? Well, no one would, so let's skip this and go on to the next thing that might interest someone. I mean, it takes a tremendous... It really takes a tremendous ego to assume that anything at all you have to say would be of interest to anyone else.
Yeah.
And so you understand you're really out there exposed. I mean, you're spilling your guts to people, and the least you can do is try to do it well and in a way that's useful to them.
That's the thing, too, is that I find that you do well, and I don't know if you mean to do it well, is you do... As much as I talk about like being like transcendent in writing, or transcending genre writing and turning it into art and something that's beautiful and that can move people emotionally or make them reconsider the world and their place in it, you also deal in the technical.
Mm-hmm.
There's a thing I read in your new book that had never occurred to me before, where I can't remember what piece it was in, but you'll remember this when I bring it up, is that, let me approach this a different way. If I'm standing on a riverbank, okay,
mm-hmm,
and I see a trout rise, I'll be like, there's a trout, okay? And then I'll see, let's say I'm slightly down, I'm looking like downstream, I'm facing the river and I'm looking downstream toward 10 o'clock. And I'm like, there's a trout. And then all of a sudden, a couple minutes later, fish rises at 2 o'clock. I say, there's another one. And then one goes at noon, and I'll be like, another one. And it wasn't until reading your recent book that it occurred to me that that could be, a fish who's moving around.
Mm-hmm.
It's just like I get it now, but it's like never conceptually. I always would have been like 1, 2, 3 trout.
Yeah, I
the idea that he's like actively going back and forth through some area.
Yeah,
creating the illusion that most guys would come and think it was a shitload of trout.
I figured that out on the Henry's Fork years ago. These big trout would get in a run, usually not drakes, but smaller bugs, and they would just they drift down a run, and they just eat one here, and they'd move up and eat one there, and eat one there, and might eat 5 bugs, and then they just drop down and just drop back and do it again. And your first thought is, there are 6 big rainbows in here.
Oh, yeah. And you're still casting to where the one went.
Exactly.
Because you just, and you're, even though you know fish move all over the place, you talk about another thing in a Labrador where they put some kind of tracking mechanism or tag on a brook trout that traveled 30 miles upriver.
Yeah.
But, like, I get that intellectually. Like, I understand that. But in looking at, like, when a fish rises, somehow I realize, it's just funny now, all these years I've sat there, I've imagined him somehow being, like, static in space.
Mm-hmm.
So often they are.
Yeah, a lot of times they are.
He really is just there.
They just, fish do whatever they need to do to survive and flourish. Whatever they need to do, within reason. They can't get out and walk on land, but some of them stay in a half mile of stream their whole life. Some of them go out to the ocean, swim to the Sea of Japan, and eat shrimp. You know, they just do what they want. They do what they need to do.
Is that like, is understanding that kind of keep you going as a fisherman? Because I mean, I know you obviously fish because that's it's become your livelihood, right? So there's that mm-hmm. extra bit of motivation. But like, how do you really, like, what keeps you fishing? Because you kind of write about fishing some of these same places where you've been fishing these same places for decades.
Well, because you never quite get it right. Same thing that keeps you writing. I mean, you might do well at it, but you're never going to completely do it right or exhaust the subject. And it's fun. So you keep doing it. It's pretty simple.
Yeah. Like, you feel like you've never mastered anything.
Mm-mm.
With fishing.
No. Fishing or writing or anything else.
Anything else worth doing.
Yeah.
You have a line in one of your books, in an earlier book I read, and you also mentioned in your new book, this idea that that there's, when it comes to fishing, and I've quoted you on this a number of times, even to some audiences, where you say in fishing, there you tend to view the world as there's your party.
Mm-hmm.
And then the assholes.
Right.
But it's what's funny when I read that from you is that
everybody does that.
Yeah. But what's funny, like a guy like you, though, is you're producing all this beautiful work for the consumption of, obviously, the assholes. Like, you hope to sell books beyond your immediate social circle. So it just, like, brings up this interesting idea of, like, how, like, I generally, like, in life, right, I want, like, when I look at politically and culturally in the country, sort of a question I ask myself when I look at things that are going on, I'm like, what's best for hunters and fishermen?
Yeah.
It's just like I feel that obligation personally, and I feel that obligation professionally to kind of look at that lens of like, what's good for hunters and fishermen in America on this issue. I have that, but I also have the feeling of when you pull in and there's a truck there where you're going and you're like, son of a bitch.
Yeah.
Hate that guy. It's like a funny thing of perception.
Yeah. Yeah. But see, everybody else thinks that too. I mean, if I pull up in a river and go, well, look, there's an asshole standing in my pool. He looks back at me in my pickup truck and goes, well, that asshole wants my pool. Yeah. We all do it. And
it's, well, like, what's your take on it? I mean, do you think about it much, or is it just like just a natural thing?
Oh, it's just a natural thing. And if you just go talk to the guy,
you wind up loving him.
Yeah. I mean, if you just, I've had people come up and stand while I was fishing and I'll say, you want in? I'll go to the next pool.
Do you have a sort of a composite kind of individual or a friend or whatever that when you're writing, you imagine yourself that they're your bullshit gauge?
Yeah.
That they're who you're talking to?
I do. I mean, it changes from time to time, but I developed this trick. I wrote a column a week for 28 years. I can't do the math, but there's a lot of stinking columns in the newspaper, but mostly about fishing, some hunting, some other stuff. And, you know, I started that when I was pretty young, and I kind of struggled with the style I wanted. I always wanted to write in a very conversational style. And I had this running correspondence with my oldest continuous friend, Ed Engel, who's also a fishing writer. And we were also poets together back in the day.
Oh, so you guys go way back.
Yeah. And he's worked for the Forest Service. He's a fantastic outdoorsman. But we had this correspondence, and it just flowed like water. And I, one day, just on a whim, I was going to write a story about, I don't know, going fishing somewhere, and I just typed Dear Ed. And I just told the story like I was writing to Ed, except, you know, like slightly more in complete sentences. And,
yeah, no, I understand. Yeah.
And less profanity.
You fulfilled your obligations to the reader.
And then when I was done, I scratched out Dear Ed, and that was it. Right?
Yeah.
No, see, good tip that you used to always give me. When we were writing the guidebook, you'd say, yeah, just imagine you're at the bar with one of your buddies that doesn't know quite as much about the subject as you do. You had a beer or two. You're feeling, you know, pretty loose. You can roll it all out fast, and then imagine you're just going to deliver that content to that person.
Yeah.
It's similar to that.
I remember in writing school, in graduate school, I would turn in, you know, these pieces in workshop, and I was working on magazine pieces that I later published, and a teacher became a very dear friend of mine, Deirdre McNamer, a novelist. She would say, she would look at it and be like, now you're like writing.
Yeah.
Now you're writing, and it's annoying to me. You know, it was better when I felt that you were like telling me something.
Yep.
You know, because you're slipping into this thing how you imagine a writer would sound.
Tom Wolfe gave a series of lectures somewhere, Princeton or somewhere, and I a friend of mine had him, and I listened to him. And he said a great thing. He said that his students, he'd hear them around campus, and he said they spoke so easily, and they had this real facility with language and slang, and they were playful. And then he said, you get them in a writing class, and they write like they're Victorian lawyers.
Yeah.
With all these heretofores and whereases and stuff. And he said, my job was to say, you already play the instrument. Just write it down.
Yeah.
You know, you've been talking for 20 years. You know how to have a conversation. Just write it down.
Yeah. But it's not a given that everyone knows how to have a conversation, but I think that it's a given that most people who go into the field probably come from that, because they have sort of like a love of like explaining and telling.
Mm-hmm.
For the bullshit thing that I'm talking about, which probably the same thing, like your friend Ed, I have in my head, like anything I do, like whatever kind of media I might be dealing with in the moment, I always try to imagine the response of my two older brothers.
Yeah.
And gauging, like, if I'm doing good, it's the kind of thing that I would hope that they would stumble across.
Mm-hmm.
If I'm not being my best self, it's the kind of thing where I'm like, I hope those guys don't stumble across this.
Yeah.
And that to me is like worked well as a guide, but I don't think everyone has the luxury of having older brothers who are interested in the same shit they're interested in.
Yeah.
Which I realize is a luxury. You know, it is a luxury. Yeah.
The luxury I've had is I've had some really good colleagues and teachers who've taught me things about writing. And often, not much, but but just a little piece that I can put together. I always think of Ed because he's a withering critic. I mean, he's really just cut you down to size. He once said of Trout Bum, somebody asked him how he liked Trout Bum, and he said, well, he said, I think it makes up in enthusiasm what it lacks in quality.
Yeah.
Ouch!
I don't know, man. I see from your perspective that might be bad, but here's the thing. Like, a word that sticks in my head for not just Trout Bum, but all your books is just like an exuberance.
Yeah.
I don't know if you really like life and being alive as much as yourself on the page does, but there's an infectious enthusiasm for just being alive.
Well,
I've had a good time with it. But
know?
It's not like you paint it as just, it's not like you paint being alive as just like nothing but just good times and laughs.
Yeah.
Because being alive is, in some ways, it's a struggle and a hassle. Mm-hmm. But you paint being alive as like something that's really worth doing.
Yeah. Well, don't you think it is?
Yeah. But I think it's also easy to fall into a trap where you lose sight of how worthwhile it all is.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure.
Or that you don't take time to say to yourself, like, my God, is it worthwhile being alive?
Yeah. Yeah.
Because you can have weeks go by without realizing that. And it's like one of the beauties of the natural world is, like, for me, the reminder, I get it through my kids now because I have young kids. But for me, a long time, the only real genuine reminder of that was the natural world.
Yeah.
It was the time that I would be like, holy shit, being alive, man, I need to do more of this. Would be like inspired by, by how much you love your friends and love being outside with them.
Yeah.
And seeing things with them. And now, like, I get it in a very different way because I get it because I have young kids. And the minute you need, anytime you feel like slogged down or slowed down or in a bog, just take 1 second to imagine not being able to see them grow into what they'll become.
Right.
And it makes you just really, really glad.
Yeah.
About the fact that you're breathing air. Because it's such a daunting, miserable thought.
Well, and you know, you spend a lot of time outside, you know, with other people who spend a lot of time outside, and you just see great stuff.
Yeah.
You know, you see beautiful stuff. And not everybody, I don't think everybody has that in their life. And, or they don't, you know, you schlep off to work for the 9,000th day in a row. You know, maybe you don't look around and go, "Geez, it's a nice day."
Do you self identify as an environmentalist, like in the way that many people would recognize that? I think when you're talking about, you know, you spend a lot of time talking about like habitat for fish, so like what fish need to live. Mm-hmm. But you also spend time talking about just sort of like the general, way that things go with nature. And I think that, and sometimes in there's like a bit of, in your voice and in your worldview, there's a bit of cynicism and maybe like a little bit of pessimism that we won't be able to stop the bleeding.
Yeah, well, I think that we may not be able to. I mean, it's hard when you've just had the two biggest hurricanes on record within months of each other, and we've pulled out of the Paris Accords.
Yeah.
And the EPA is dropping all their regulations, all their environmental regulations. And you think, well, I don't know, maybe this is the end. But, you know, all you can do is just say to people in a roundabout way, this is, not only is this beautiful and worthwhile, not only is it good for you to spend time out here, but we'll die without it.
Yeah.
And you really should maybe think about that the next time you go to the polls. Or maybe you should just think about going to the stinking polls. I mean, it kills me that half the eligible voters in this country don't vote. After all the people who've died, so they have a right to vote.
Yeah. That's a good way of putting it.
You know, it's just shameful.
Do you think that you have an obligation in your work? Like when you bring up an idea in your books, I remember you're talking about being in some remote outpost somewhere. I can't remember what it was, and you're saying that everyone there was either there to go fishing or there for mineral extraction.
Mm-hmm.
And you kind of talked about the two different views they had of the future of that place. When you're talking about that kind of stuff and thinking about those things, are you putting it in there because you can't? You can't help yourself but put it in there? Or do you feel that you have an obligation, because you're talking to outdoorsmen and fishermen, do you have an obligation to steer them in a direction that you feel that they need to go in order to understand?
Probably a little of both. I don't sit down at the keyboard with a sense of obligation. But when something like that comes up, I feel like I should make note of it,
mm-hmm.
just to keep people aware. I mean, a lot of ways, I'm just preaching to the choir. I don't know if there's a lot of people who read me who wouldn't consider themselves environmentalists or conservationists or, you know, in some way.
So you don't think that somewhere there's a guy, I bet you there are. I bet you there are guys who read you and think you're funny, and they love to fish, but it annoys them when you go down that path.
Oh, yeah, I suppose there are.
There are. I mean, I'm not saying I've talked to them, but yeah. There are.
Yeah, yeah. Because... No, there have to be. Well, I don't care. I mean, people like that need to be tweaked, too.
Yeah.
I mean, maybe they just need to be reminded, well, all these guys I'm hanging out with having such a great time, they're worried about the environment. I wonder if I should look into that.
Yeah.
You know, I don't know.
And you have concerns too. So there's like the environment, which is like the place we live in what's in our backyards and what's in our communities and just this big, huge, broad thing. But you also seem to have a lot of concerns for wilderness. And mm-hmm. there was a thing that you mentioned, you're talking about float planes. And you start out, this is in a fly rod of your own, and you're talking about float planes. You start out by describing this kind of like crazy place you arrive at,
mm-hmm.
and the things that go on there and the wildlife there, and there's like graves, some possibly old French trappers laying around, and all, and this 10-foot-high mound of caribou antlers. And you paint this picture, and you go like, yeah, that's the kind of place where a float plane can get you. And then you go on to explain how you used to have a more... you had this like different view of float planes and the access they provided. And now that your view of float planes is sort of tainted by the idea that, oh, that's right, everything comes at a cost.
Yeah. Yeah.
And the simple fact of this plane allowing me to be here in some way that's a corrupting force too now.
Well, yeah.
And it brings this bittersweet sort of feeling to it.
Yeah, but it's just by way of reminding people that there is a cost. I mean, I think I remember that passage. It's something like, you know, you've gone to this absolutely remote, beautiful, pristine place, and you step out of the float plane under the pontoon as there's a stinking oil slick from your plane.
Yeah, your plane.
Yeah. And I just feel it's worth reminding people that that's there. But it isn't, I don't know how calculated it is. You know what I mean? I mean, it occurs to me, and I'm writing about what's happening with me, so I say, well, here's this.
Yeah, because in my stream of consciousness, this is a real theme that ought to be explored.
Yeah.
And I mean, passes the test of, is this something that people are going to give a shit about?
I should show you the photograph. I've got it somewhere. a good friend of mine, Mike Dvorak, wonderful black and white photographer, took some photos on a trip to Labrador, and one of them is this beautiful shot down the board dock out to the float plane, beautiful old de Havilland beaver tied up, and in the foreground are just oil barrels.
Yeah.
Like 20 or 30 of them. And I said, I asked him, was that intentional? He said, oh, hell yes.
Yeah, that's good. Have you read John McPhee's Coming Into the Country, his History of Alaska?
Yeah, but not for a long time.
He spends a significant portion of that book talking about the oil drums, oil barrels. And it's really like, in a way, it's not heavy-handed, but it's just this ever-present thing is oil drums.
Well, Alaska is, I mean, you go up to Alaska, it's beautiful, it's wilderness, you catch all these fish, and the whole, the only reason there's any civilization up there is oil and salmon.
Yeah. Yeah, it's crazy to think about. It used to be, 100 years ago, it was sea otters.
Yeah.
I've had a feeling, just kind of back to that feeling of the conflictedness, right, that you love places and so you want to go see them, but knowing that somehow your presence.
Yep.
I've had criticism before. Like I was hunting one time in ANWR, the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge, and I remember hearing criticism from someone, I can't remember who it was pointing out like how unfair it was. Be like, here you are, you want this place to be hands off, and no one can go there, but you get to go there. Like you have the economic means to go here, and so you're saying like all the things that should or shouldn't happen here, most people would never be able to go there. What gives you a right to have an opinion about what happens to this place? It's not fair.
Yeah.
And I remember thinking like if I could make a deal right now, though, if someone came to me and said,
yeah, we'll never touch it again,
but
you can't go,
I would say deal.
Yeah, me too.
I would say okay, great.
Me too.
Let's get the lawyer and sign this. Let's get the lawyer and draw this thing up right now. I will never come back.
And since that'll never happen, people just have to believe you when you say that.
Yeah, no, it's a tricky thing. It's a tricky thing. What do you feel about? Where do you feel that catch and release fishing is at? In light of new thinking and new awareness that you see in the food world, in the chef world, of people sort of having this idea that they're reconnecting with sources of food, and people want to have these experiences where you see food go from the water to your plate.
Yeah, I think it's useful and necessary to a degree, because there are too many people fishing for the fisheries not to be degraded seriously. So I think the idea that, I fish a lot, and if I killed all the fish I caught, I would make a big dent.
Yeah, but
But I think it's permissible. I was never one of those guys who thought killing a fish was murder.
Yeah.
And I've written about that any number of times. Talk about eating a char at the end of the book.
Yeah.
And
the guy chunking up char and mixing it in with under the seat of a plane.
Well, there was that, but there was also we went out and caught a couple of big char, like 6-8 pound char, beautiful fish, and flew them back. And Francis, the camp cook, cooks them up. But I said in that, I said something like, I didn't blink when I killed it, and I didn't think twice about it. Somehow I felt like the world owed me that fish.
Yeah.
And I was happy to eat it.
There's another passage where you're up in a place and you're fishing. And you actually talk about you're in camp and, I don't know if it's the same trip. You're talking about being up there and eating king salmon.
Mm-hmm.
But then you do kind of point out that some of these places, like in Alaska, when you get these glimpses of abundance, right? Because in Alaska, you'd be in a river in 10 and a half months out of the year. I mean, shit in the river, right? But then there's this flurry, and people coincide their trips to catch the flurry, and it creates this like sense of never-ending abundance.
Mm-hmm.
And you talk about this feeling that some people have a hard time being around that without being, I'm going to take 50 pounds of these things home and let them get freezer burned in my freezer. When thinking about the, you know, the environment and the state of clean water and healthy fisheries and wildlife habitat, you kind of get into this point where you're talking about you can either live with regret about the things that are gone or the things that have become overexploited.
Mm-hmm.
Like live with regret and become bitter or just look for new water.
Yeah.
And I feel like you're being metaphorical there.
Yeah, for sure. Good pickup on that. Yeah.
Like can you explain your thinking on that? Like kind of what you mean when you say that in a literal sense and what you kind of mean in a more figurative sense. Like live with regret or look for new water.
Well, in a figurative sense, it's what we were talking about earlier. Yeah, you know, maybe the world's ending, but why give up?
Yeah.
I mean, we could stop it, maybe. We could turn things around. So, I mean, you can't just give up, right?
Yeah.
And then there's the subtext of every time you go find new water, you know, you're one more guy exploiting that place.
Mm-hmm.
So I just would like people to think about this stuff. It doesn't mean you have to change what you do or anything. I mean, I don't plan to stop fishing because I think there's too heavy a burden on the streams. But I think it's worthwhile to be aware that there is too heavy a burden on the streams. That's why a lot of us catch and release fish.
Yeah. To continue doing what you love, but not have a...
Yeah. Just, I mean, there's no... You know, I'm happy to go someplace, catch two fish. There's a little creek up here, not too far from here. I like to go up there in the late summer, fall, and get a couple of brook trout and a handful of perfect little doorknob-sized Boletus mushrooms and some wild raspberries, and either cook them there or come home, cook them at home. Yeah, I usually cook them a little. They're usually a little better if I cook them at home. And I would never want to lose that.
Yeah.
And a lot of places I go, kill a fish and eat it. Shore lunch.
Yeah, you talk about that in your book.
We were in the Northwest Territories a couple of years ago, and Great Bear Lake, and the fishing was so good, we wanted a 5-pound lake trout for lunch, and we had to fish all morning till almost 1 o'clock to catch one that small.
Oh, is that right? Yeah.
And I mean, that's just, it really is wonderful to see that kind of abundance.
For sure.
But you gotta, there are people who would have kept all those fish if they could.
Yeah.
Not as many as there used to be. I mean, I really think people are becoming aware that, you know, why kill 50 pounds of fish?
Like more aware about the finiteness of nature.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, if I can do it, everybody else could do it, and then what happens? I think it was in that book, I recounted an argument between a bush pilot and a yep. sport, and the guy said, well, why not keep 50 pounds of salmon? They're going to die anyway. And the pilot said, well, they're going to die after they spawn, and every one you kill is one that isn't going to spawn.
Yep.
And then he went on to ask the guy, are you really that stupid, or are you just playing dumb so you can go on being an asshole?
Yeah. Yeah. No, that's a term you used to see so much. I think I read it in your thing. It's like there used to be this idea of the game hog.
Yeah.
Which I hadn't heard in a long time.
Uh-huh.
You're careful about not naming places that would be easy for people to get to.
Mm-hmm.
But have you come under criticism with friends, or have you ever felt like that because your work's so widely known that you've provided sort of a compass and map to people looking for good fishing, or doesn't it work that way? That you write about somewhere and then come back and it's different than it was because you personally drove everyone there.
I've never been directly criticized for that, but I know it happens. I mean, I've written about the South Platte River, Cheeseman Canyon down through Deckers, which isn't as good now as it used to be. And it's really not because of fishing pressure so much as whirling disease and then flash floods that silted everything in, killed a lot of bugs. And, you know, it's coming back in after a fashion. But that was crowded when I first wrote about it. And is it more crowded now because I wrote about it? Yeah, maybe. I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
But I've never really been held to account for that, but I'm aware of it. I'm aware it happens.
Yeah, but I think that it's probably safe to say that...
But it's also why I'm so careful about not saying where places are. Some places, Ed Engel again, said to me once, his rule is he won't write about any stream he can roll cast across. And he said, and I can roll cast a hell of a long way.
That's good. You, the thing I think to keep in mind is that regulated recreational fishermen are not going to destroy a fishery. They might destroy some bit of the experience of participating in the fishery, but mm-hmm. they're not going to destroy the fishery.
They're not going to fish out every fish like a toxic spill would.
Yeah.
But they're going to degrade it to the point where you once could go catch 18 to 20-inch fish on a dry fly. Now the best you can do is a foot-long fish.
You've seen that.
Not quite to that extreme, but yeah, I've seen it.
Like you've felt the repercussions of a lot of recreational fishing.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And then you have a thing that you're talking about in a funny way. You're talking about being in a camp in the past. You're talking about having been pretty drunk where you're blowing on a fire and like passed out in the fire and burnt your beard.
Yeah.
And then I think in that same thing you talk about, you just don't drink like you kind of like don't drink like you used to.
Yeah.
Is that sort of is stopping drinking sort of like this acknowledgement that, is it like a personal acknowledgement that you won't be on earth forever? Or was it different than that?
Well, I think I always knew I wasn't going to be on earth forever.
Yeah, we know but we don't know it.
No, it was more that I knew I was drinking more than I probably should. And I knew it wasn't good for me, and I wasn't feeling good, and I was in my 40s, I was making a living as a writer, and I just thought, I'm not enjoying this like I used to. It doesn't make me feel good. And I need my wits about me if I'm going to keep doing this. I think it was less an actual intimation of mortality and more just the idea that at 40, I could have another 40 years in me
mm-hmm.
if I don't pickle my brains, right?
Yeah.
But if I pickle my brains, maybe I've only got 20.
Was it Mickey Mantle who said, if I'd have known I was going to live this long, I would have
taken better care of myself? Yeah.
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 I find that like a joke I often make is when I think about how old I am or other people's age, I always double it and then remind them that they're halfway to X.
Yeah.
So I'm not halfway to 86.
Yeah.
What's helpful is I know how long I've been alive and I can picture that span of time. So understanding where I'm at in the halfway mark helps me like conceptualize whether or not I have that long again reaching out ahead of me. And I'm now at the point where I might not have the amount of time behind me ahead of me. I could. Yeah.
Well, try being halfway to 140.
Do you feel like you're going to be doing more books? Are you going to keep writing? Like, do you have a plan and not write? Or do you think just write till you just cannot write?
Well, I'm going to write till I can't write. I just signed a contract earlier this year for two more books over 6 years.
With your same publisher?
Yeah. So
that's a nice relationship you've had with your publisher, man. A long, nice relationship, huh?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, it isn't all sweetness and roses, but, you know, it's kind of a weird, friendly but slightly adversarial relationship. But, yeah, they've been good to me. Simon Schuster's been a really good outfit.
Yeah.
And, I mean, they've made me a good living, and my agent, Pamela Malpas, too.
Do you want to say any kind of, like, do you have any kind of little stump speech plug you'd like to give for your new book?
Yeah.
I would like to give one.
Go ahead.
I think that I want to say if you like to fish, but I think it's like if you like to fish, laugh, if you like being alive on Earth, I think it's like worthwhile to check out John Gearock's latest book, which is just like new, right? Fairly new.
Yeah, just this spring.
A fly rod of your own, and it is your 17th or 18th or something like that?
18th.
So once you tuck into that book and dig it, you do not need to worry about running out of more books for a while.
Yeah, they're all still in print, thank God.
Thank you very much for joining us on the show.
Happy to do it.